Greetings, everyone. First time in 16 years since I've been to Sydney. And my wife, who is here, has never been to Australia before, nor have some of the other people traveling with us. You've heard a little bit about the trip so far. We landed in Auckland, and the young lady came aboard to spray the interior with some sort of a DDT or something, whatever it was. So all of us were sniffling and having a reaction on the way to the hotel, and it went from bad to worse because I didn't have any speak, and of course it was kind of cold and windy and rainy. So here I am with a pretty good head cold now as a result with a kind of a sinus problem. My apologies then that my voice sounded a little thick this afternoon, but that's the risk you run sometimes. We already were able to speak to, I didn't count them, but I guess 800 or 900 or more people up in Brisbane. Just barely got here from there. And we'll be going on to speak to brethren all over the rest of the major populated areas of Australia. So it's a nostalgic trip for me because when I was first here, I guess it was in 59 or 60, I've forgotten, or someone, maybe Mr. Don Abraham remembers the year that we started the office. 59 was it when Gerald and I were down here? And we came down and found the original offices over in North Sydney and began a little fledgling work down here. I don't know if there was a single baptized member in the church at all at that time. I really don't remember. Smile, you're on candid camera over there. I kept crying after that other visit. I think I was down here in 61 and we still just had a very little beginning, and I remember some of the people who were here, but very, very few. And Mr. Waterhouse by that time I think was on his way back up, he was up in the Philippines, and I think Mr. Cole was newly here. And then from that time to this, would you believe practically every year I said, well, I've got to get down to Australia. I've got to try to take a trip into Australasia. I need to get back to Manila or someplace. And always something came up, and we had more urgent things back there, and just never did get around to it for one reason or a dozen. So finally, here we are. It's kind of like a Feast of Tabernacles to me to be rushing off from one service to the next and in a constant hurry everywhere we go, but it has to be done that way in order to meet the schedule. As Mr. McCullough mentioned, we've already spoken to four different areas over in New Zealand, and spoke to the brethren over in Honolulu. First time I've been there on a Sabbath, by the way, too. I don't know where I got my globe-trotting reputation. I think people mixed me up with my father or something. But I had never in the history of the work, and the Honolulu church has been there for many, many years, even taken the opportunity to get out to Honolulu for a Sabbath and use it as an excuse to spend Sunday on the beach or something. But at least we did this time, though we didn't get to the beach, but we did get to the church. And we're going to enjoy very much the opportunity to see the people up in the Philippines. I've heard so much about those people and how warm and friendly they are from other people who have been there, Mr. McCullough and others, and so it'll be our pleasure to be able to see them. I know that the first thing many people ask me is, how is my father doing? And I'd like to ask you first, how many of you read the Worldwide News? The Worldwide News, the newspaper that we put out. Do most of you? I hope so. Well, then you probably already know, pretty much up to date. I was able to run over there and visit him again just barely before beginning this trip, and he was making inch-by-inch progress, so as you can understand, it's very painfully slow and difficult really to assess on a week-to-week basis. I'd put it this way. When my father was last up and around and on his trip, he seemed to look about like a man of 65 or 6 or so would. He had very good color. He seemed to be full of stamina and energy. And when he would be speaking, he seemed to speak with the same kind of vitality he'd always had. And yet after recovering and coming back, from this very near scrape of death where his heart actually stopped beating for some few seconds from what is called congestive heart failure. When you see him and talk to him now, suddenly he is exactly 85. And I can't say that he looks, ill or like that when you'd see him. You'd probably still be impressed. I would say right now my father looks infinitely better than most people 85. But he does look and he does act and he does talk like a person 85. He gets up very slowly, and he walks from room to room, and he'll have to pause a moment and sit down and gather his strength and then go on to the next room. As I've mentioned to you, I've kept you pretty well up to date, as I will immediately, when I get back again, go right straight over and visit him and tell him about our trip down here to Australia. The current problem is that he is suffering from a lack of red blood corpuscles. So, of course, he's taking a lot of supplementary iron, but as I'm told, you don't really gain any strength. You just sort of stay static with that. You can't really build back your strength unless your own body is producing the red blood corpuscles. So until that problem is over, he's just going to remain pretty well steady where he is. I don't know how long it's going to take for him to get back on the same schedule. People have asked me, does he intend to continue his visits overseas, and the answer to that is if, of course, he recovers to the point that he is able, and he most assuredly intends to continue doing that. I'd like to give you a little preview when I was up for the very first time to see the offices at Burleigh Head yesterday. That was yesterday. They were mailing out the letter that I'd sent to all the brethren in the United States and other parts of the world, and yours is being mailed, so you haven't gotten it yet. I prefer to show you this without the jacket because that's not of my design that I'll explain. But anyway, I'm sending you a letter in which I've gotten a special deal with a publisher to give all of our church members, one head of household, this new book absolutely free of charge. And that's an unusual bargain for the church because, frankly, we would not have been able to publish it and have advertised it on the air and in the plain truth and over radio and so on free of charge ourselves because the cost would have been something like, oh, I suppose $8 or better per copy. Well, what is here is only 50% of what I wrote. They have, because of the constraints of size and marketability to keep it down under the $10 mark in the United States, tried to drastically edit it down. They got it down to $8.95 in the hardback version in the United States in bookstores. And consequently, several things happened that was not of my doing, and I wish they hadn't done it that way. I told Bob Kuhn, who was coordinating it with Pete Alexander McNeil, who were the publishers over in Kansas City, I said, look, of all things, I do not want, especially the very first book I've ever written, I've written booklets and articles and all that, but I've never authored a book before. I do not want my picture on the cover, and especially with a book about Jesus. What in the world am I doing with my dumb face on the cover on a book about such a subject? Would you believe they put it on there 11 times? 11 pictures. Unbelievable. See, 3, 6, 9, 10, yeah, 11 of them. And it's from a sort of an advertising montage that they had used during some of the campaigns in Canada and the United States, a lot of candid shots all fused together. And then where they staked this one up, I don't know, but my wife and I both just screamed when we saw it. Oh, no, how did that get on there? So I'll have to track down someone, find out who gave it to them. But they put about an 8 or 9 or 10-year-old, maybe it's taken in 1961. I don't know why publishers do that. I mean, people do get older. And I am absolutely, you know, limp, anemic, gray-headed now, and look very different when I saw a picture of me in Australia in 1960, or whenever it was. Little tiny, narrow ties were in. And I had on a little string black tie with a little pin thing. That you had pin-down collars in those days. Recall that? President Kennedy was in office. The Vietnam War hadn't even really gotten heated up very much when I was last in Australia. And I had what looked to be almost like a crew cut and totally black hair. I may have had one or two gray ones somewhere, but now they're just about all gray and about half of them gone from that time to this. Anyway, there's the book, and I hope that all of you will have an opportunity to read it. I may give you a little segment or two out of it a little later in connection with some of the things that I may say. Some of the portions of this book I wish they had left in. But I would have been the poorest person to make those decisions because I think anyone who writes something tends to be awfully close to it, and you would just hate to cut any of it out. So perhaps it's better that they did it instead of myself. I'd like to introduce you to a few people right quickly. Mr. and Mrs. Les McCullough, you know. I don't know if you've met his wife, Marion. You all know Mr. and Mrs. Dean Wilson. We're newly down here, but I don't think you've seen or met my wife, Shirley, before over here at the side. And my middle son, David, who is 22. And they might at least stand up so some of you short people can see them to wave hello. And as I think you all well know, both David and Matthew were born profoundly deaf, but they were very greatly blessed by having speech therapy from a young lady in the church even before she got married, Mona Zachary, who is now Mrs. Dale Sugar, and then being able to go through the schools affiliated with the church, so they were able to go to normal classes and go right on through high school. They read lips very well. They will understand you, I think, most. I don't know if they understand Australian accents yet, if David has trouble with that or not, but they understand very well. David is the guy that I talked about in sermons and mentioned from time to time who wanted to take up with skydiving. And he's now bailed out of aircraft up to 12,500 feet over 300 separate times. And, of course, being a pilot, that just scares the daylights out of me. I like to have wings out there when I'm in the air and don't like to have the idea of plummeting through the air. The other day, he saw a great tragedy occur, and I'd hoped that it might dampen his spirits, but it didn't at all. He was sad by it, of course, and he saw a man die, but they closed down the field because some younger person that had only jumped about 20 times decided to wait until way too late, and he would have gotten away with it. Of course, if his first shoot had opened up all right, he's wearing a Sarah Commander, but something happened, and it was all about halfway twisted up, and he had to jettison that and try to open his reserve chute, and it blossomed just barely at the same instant that his body struck the ground. So a young man of about 18 or whatever was dead, and someone had to call his parents, and I lived with that, my wife, of course, a lot. But on the other hand, we've had to realize that if he didn't have that as a challenge and as an interest or an awful lot of other interests that he could have taken up with, it wouldn't be quite so pleasing. I'd almost rather have him skydiving than driving a motorcycle on the freeways in Los Angeles, for example. So that's one of the things that you live with. Well, I'd like to talk to you a little more just from a personal standpoint, or even open it up to questions and answers and find out what's on your mind. I have some remarks prepared to talk to you about here a little bit. For me, this is a trip back in nostalgia, as I mentioned to the brethren in Brisbane. For one thing, when you go around to some of these areas overseas and you see young men that you were out playing basketball with seemingly only a few years ago in Brickettwood or Big Sandy or Pasadena, and now suddenly they're mature men with families and over very large responsibilities in various parts of the world in the ministry or some administrative job, it gives you a great deal of pleasure to realize what has been accomplished. And in the larger sense, to look now at a very well established and growing church organization in Australia of the radio and television coverage that we have had down here and now newly on television and beginning to cover the nations we never had before, and seeing all of the faces of people who have begun to be converted and become members of the Church of God, it is really bearing fruit. And I'd like to talk to you about that a little bit. Just what in the world am I doing in Australia? Well, if Australia were some prime target for wayward United States evangelists, I assure you I would have been down here at least once a year for the last 16. I've not been given the impression that Americans should open their mouths to criticize Australians because of their lifestyle, because as an American, I do not have all that much of which to be proud. Now, if I talk about my land, my country, my history, past, present, if I talk about those days coming out of a Great Depression when the Judeo-Christian Protestant work ethic was in vogue and when Americans had the notion that even though only 5% of the population owned or possessed 85% of the wealth, that that was not necessarily an evil, and that the sociological trends of a welfare state, the feather bedding, had not yet become so completely inculcated into American economic structures that the American people were perhaps a different people in the days of World War II than they are now. Just as the British people were a completely different people when they had their backs to the wall in 1940, when the American Congress passed the law to begin military conscription, to begin the draft, after Hitler had invaded much of Europe, after the Battle of Britain was well underway, the American Congress passed the law to begin military conscription by one vote with our isolationist ideals in that country. From that time to this, we are a completely different people than we were when I was able to grow up in the United States, up in Oregon during the World War II years when we read all that was happening down in this part of the world. And as I think back over that span of time, I can't help but reminisce about what has happened to the world at large in so short a period of time comparatively. Now, as I stare the age 50 in the face here in the next couple of years, it's a profound and a different experience for me. Because I can remember so clearly that day when I was 11, helping my mother doing the walking, when she said, "Hush, Ted," and turned up the radio, and we listened to some frantic announcement about some place I'd never heard of before called Pearl Harbor. And she said she had to go call my dad at the office, and she did, and tell him to listen to it. And we proceeded to listen to the radio that day that talked about the Japanese attack at a place called Pearl Harbor. I don't know where that was. It might have been off the Oregon coast and down in California. I was only 11. But then as I found out a little more, I went out and gathered bottles that day. And in those days, I could get a Coke bottle, and I could get a penny or so back for it, or a beer bottle. So I would go out along the highways with my gunny sack, and I would gather up bottles to get enough money to go to the movie. They cost 11 cents in those days. And I went downtown to a movie, and I saw a movie about Penrod. Never forget that. It was something about a balloon, and they mistakenly let the thing go, and here they were up floating around in a balloon. Well, during the afternoon, they would flash little typewritten notices, as they did in those days, across the screen about the number of ships that were damaged or sunk. They didn't give all the statistics that they told about the beginning of a great world war. And that night, it was after dark when I got out of the movie, That was in the winter in Oregon. The days were very short. And it was raining, as usual, in December on that 7th, that late evening. And there was a Japanese behind every bush all the way home. I was whistling to myself, you know, going along with my music, hoping that there weren't any monsters around. Dramatic things began to occur in the world. And my father, who was a person of whom I began on age 13, 14, and 15 to be somewhat ashamed, because I deeply resented being a young person from a religious family, most especially a religious family that kept the wrong day. I never could figure that out. I was embarrassed by it. The older I got, the more up into teenage, the more embarrassed I became, because all of my buddies in high school were able to go out for sports, and they were able to just live with the world like normal people. Now, even though they might have been Presbyterians or Episcopalians or Baptists or Methodists, they weren't necessarily right down there resting around on the ground fighting with one another. They may have had different beliefs, like a young Canadian told me one time. He was on his way to church, and he was walking along a dusty road, and the neighbor from down the way came along and stopped his old Model A and said, "Ken, young boy, would you like a lift over here to church?" And he said, "Well, surely." He said, "Well, get in." He jumped in, went down the road about a section, about a mile or so, and he said, "Here's my church. I'd better get out." And he pulled into the churchyard and let the young boy out. The young boy on reflection thought, "Now, wait a minute. Mr. So-and-so, you're going to church, aren't you?" He said, "Well, yes, I am, but my church is another mile further down the road." He said, "Well, why can't you just get out and come in here and go to church with me?" He said, "Well, I couldn't do that because I'm not a member of this church." And the young boy was only about 13 or 14. He walked in sort of for the first time in his life, puzzling about that. Was God in both places? Would he get a bigger portion of God in one place or the other? Maybe they had something different going on a mile away than was going on here. And he began to wonder at that early age, why should there be all of these different churches? Well, I was ashamed of what my father believed. I didn't know what he believed. I was just ashamed of it. Because I couldn't go out for sports, and because we lived in a very cheap house in the outskirts and unincorporated limits, outside the incorporated limits of the city, where we had overflowing septic tanks in the winter, we walked across old muddy fields to a little old unpainted tongue and groove clapboard church building that had been built by my father's and other people's own hands, and I went to sleep on little benches that they'd sawn out of lumber and put together in the church congregation, about 30, 40, 50, whatever they were during those years. And during that time, it went in one ear and out the other, of course, because I never paid very much attention to it one way or the other. But during those years, after I was 12, 13, some dramatic things were happening in the world, as you well remember. My father had begun reading in the prophecies because he didn't believe that the United States, the British Commonwealth of Nations, were the Joseph, or the Ephraim and Manasseh, of biblical prophecy. And he could see beginning in Daniel 11 in verse 30, where it said at the time of the end, a king of the south would push at a king of the north. And that king of the north would come with great fury and invade into the area of Palestine and Egypt. And he began to try to put several of these prophecies together, like the great prophecies about a so-called beast or a great military leader who was over a combine of many nations in Central Europe, together with a great leading religious figure. But you know, it was far different from the perspective of a person looking at the war news in 1942 or 3, wasn't it, than it is today in comfortable, overstuffed, undernourished America, or here in Australia. Now we're looking back, many, many years ago, at what is now old history. More than half the population of the United States are under 25 today. There were only 100 million people when I was born in 1930. Now there are about 222 or so million people in the United States. We have a comfortable view now of World War II. It's all over, and we look back. But if you had been a person who believed with all of your heart that the Bible is the Word of God in its original purity, as nearly as you can get to that original purity out of the many different translations there are, and if you believed biblical prophecy meant today that it wasn't all fulfilled back at the fall of ancient Rome or city-states or the Persian Empire or Babylon or Greece or Egypt, but that there were prophecies which meant now, today, in the future. If you believe with all of your being that Jesus Christ was not a person who just came to the earth as a nice man, who had a lot of strange revolutionary ideas, a kind of a beatnik or a hippie who came head-to-head with the establishment, started a new religion. Some people think he did it in a plot, that his disciples stole the body away, and there is a book on that. As I make a point in the beginning of this book, Jesus fell, so long as he's not the real one. like a Scandinavian who was going to do a movie on a nude Jesus going rocketing around the countryside on a motorcycle naked. Or like the people who even wrote the articles of the journals in which they claimed Jesus is not a real person but only a name for a kind of a mushroom, and actually it was a drug cult. And that cult becomes famous. People who alleged that there was some sort of a plot at the Passover, and that Jesus concocted some sort of a scheme to cause there to be virtually no cult, and that he could feign dying, his disciples could come along and steal him away at some point or other, and then he could start a great religion. Well, whatever people believe about Jesus, very few people, it seems, comparatively, believe in the real Jesus as he emerges in the pages of the Bible. Even if they believe on him, it seems many people do not believe what he said. And I can talk to people who have the notion of the immortality of the soul, or they believe in going to heaven, or they believe in being wafted away in some great, mysterious time in which they have to borrow from a word that is not even in the Bible, rapture. Strange that the word rapture is not in the Bible. You can't find that doctrine by that name. Strange that the word Trinity is not in the Bible. You can't find that one either. But many people believe in going to heaven, or they believe in at least going up to heaven for a few years and then coming back down at some later date. A 1,000-year rapture to heaven is in the case of the Adventist, to clean it all out and find out by going over the book whether they should have been there in the first place. Or maybe a 3-year trip to heaven. Or maybe just hovering around the earth while the earth is in total chaos and then coming back down after it's all over. But my father happened to believe in the Bible literally. And so he began to take things at face value. And when Jesus said that the meek shall inherit the earth, he believed it. And when the Bible says that the wages of sin is death, he believed it. And when the Bible says, as dies the one, so dies the other, that a human being dies just the way a beast does, and like your dog Rover, when you die, you're dead all over, he believes that. So he believed in biblical prophecy as being an actual revelation from God about specific events which were going to occur in the future. Now, I just say, if you had been a pastor of a church of about, say, 60 people, and on one or two little tiny fledgling radio stations up in Oregon or Washington, and it was early 1942, I don't remember the exact date of the Battle of El Alamein right now, but the furthest point that the Africa Corps got in their advance across North Africa was actually inside the borders of Egypt, where at one point the flashes and the rumbles of the guns were at least distantly visible or audible to citizens in Alexandria. And my father knew that there were great prophecies that talked about a king of the north coming into Palestine and into Egypt. And he knew that the Japanese Empire had made such tremendous advances that they were all the way up to Papua New Guinea, and that Port Moresby was under attack from time to time, that the Japanese had bombed Darwin, that they had the Marshalls and the Gilberts and the Solomons, and that we were a very, very beleaguered group of people with vast ocean lifelines such thousands of miles susceptible to interdiction by Japanese submarines, that the United States had had one little brief respite, which was merely propaganda for effect, really, when Jimmy Doolittle bombed Tokyo. But the world conditions at that time were really quite bad. You see, Japan, even then, was a bicycle economy. All materials in order to survive. The Japanese government looks at it totally differently than we do in the United States or here in Australia, and their history books are completely different about the pre-World War II days, and they will be different in the post-World War II days. Japanese children are taught different reasons as to why Japanese soldiers were invited, in a sense, into China following the Mukden Incident in about 1924, because they would make the point that Japanese soldiers were occupying strategic railway junctions, bridges, and the other toeholds that they had in the nation of China from 1924 on for the precise same reason that American troops went to Vietnam. But they would probably make the point, not without some substantiation, that perhaps the Japanese, with their normal trading areas of the vastness of China and Southeast Asia, had perhaps more business being in a navy or a neighbor oriental nation than would the white devils from across the sea. But that's our history today. The point was that the Japanese began to invade China to prevent the spread of communism. Well, Roosevelt decided, together with the other allies, that the Japanese had no business there, but in the meantime, there were some other problems heating up in the Pacific, not the least of which was a Japanese trade invasion of the western part of the world and the United States. The Japanese people had about a 2.5 year reserve in normal peacetime footing, in raw materials, such as iron, which has to be stockpiled, and oil, and rubber, and tin, and on, molybdenum, chrome, you name it, they had to have it for their war effort at that time, and they weren't producing it for themselves. In those days, the most important areas for tin, rubber, and oil were Malaysia and the Dutch East Indies. But of course, the Dutch and the British were allied together, and they between them possessed most of those areas, including some of the strategic sea gates of the Straits of Malacca, Singapore, Hong Kong. Here were the British, with these strategic sea gates, battling up much of trade. And here was the United States, with, in effect, the same type of gates, advanced fortresses, bases, from which they could actually bring about a turning point in World War, such as Wake, Guam, and the Hawaiian Islands. You know that Wake fell, and you know the story by now of Midway, and how important that proved to be, and how important this island continent proved to be, as well as New Britain and, New Zealand, primarily, with a staging area for U.S. and Anzac troops as they began to island hop on toward the island of Japan. But now, just thinking of the way the world was, when here's a person opening up the Bible to the book of Revelation about 10 kings who are going to fight Christ at his coming, 2 Thessalonians 2 about a great religious leader who was going to be in the area of Jerusalem, in Palestine, Jesus Christ himself, who in 3 separate prophecies talks about the abomination of desolation standing in a place which it ought not. This prophecy of Daniel 11, which seemed to have a typical fulfillment when Mussolini went in and took over Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Italian Somaliland and established a base at the southern approaches to the Suez Canal. And here is a prophecy that said this king of the north would actually overwhelm Egypt and Palestine. And the Africa Corps was inside Egypt, and the Japanese had swallowed up much of the Pacific. Burma had bombed Rangoon and Calcutta. If India fell and the British lost out there, no doubt the Japanese would link together with the German armies in the Middle East. Suez would go, an absolute vital link for the safety of the British Empire and the other Western allies. And then, whether someone tried to sue for peace and to prevent the total destruction of Britain and eventually the United States or not, I still say that if you were a believer in the Bible and a complete believer in the identity of the peoples of Israel and a believer in Daniel 11 and the book of Revelation and the other prophecies about 10 nations and about a great religious leader called a beast and a false prophet, a religious leader called a beast after a Gentile leader of a nation, which the Bible says are like wild animals, and if you look at Africa and other places, you can believe it. You want to mention Idi Amin and people such as this, or Adolf Hitler himself, who was mentioned, I believe, by the description, at least, in verse 21, chapter 11 of the book of Daniel, a vile person who came in, not in a time of peace, but by flattery, and obtained the kingdom, which had been vacated by a person who was called a tax collector, and the Hohenzollern family of Kaiser Wilhelm II, and it said here he'd be destroyed in a time of peace, not in anger nor in battle, he went into exile, and the German name apparently meant tax collector. So we have type anti-type. We had a weak fulfillment in World War II of what apparently was yet to occur in the future. My father was writing articles in the Plain Truth that very likely the Middle East is going to fall. And if it did, then a great internationalization, the declaration of an open city to the holy places in Jerusalem and the establishment of a great religious leader would take place. And that would become one of the most important military focal points on the face of the earth. And the Soviet Union would begin to come in that direction because it said tidings out of the east and the north shall trouble him, but he will go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly make away many. In other words, get the jump on the Soviet Union and attack first. And that would be the beginning, as the Bible says, of the day of the Lord. So my father thought that the second coming of Christ might really occur within 3 to 5 years of 1942 or 3. But Rommel was pushed back. And General Montgomery and the 8th Army began to push him back, beginning with El Alamein. And the Allies began island hopping, first in the Solomon. And they began to attack Truk and Rabaul and Tinian and Saipan and Iwo Jima and Tarawa. And on we went toward the main islands of Japan until it became quite obvious with the one little point there after the landings in Normandy at the Battle of the Bulge, in which the Germans broke through in the Schnee Eifel, and we wondered for a while if it was going to go the other way, but it all came clear finally, and GE Day and finally VJ Day occurred. Well, as a matter of practical record, in 1944, when it became painfully apparent which way the war was going to come out, from whose other point of view that might have been, my father began immediately preaching, well, then Germany has got to rise again. The Nazis and the right-wing elements, the fascists, will disappear. They will flee to countries all around the world. They will go underground. They will change their identity. By the tens of thousands, they will do this. And eventually, the German nation will rise again. And there will come a revitalized, reindustrialized, powerful German nation in Europe. And eventually, the political situation will bring about a European Union, which will once again affect exactly what Mussolini called it, the Holy Roman Empire. The Mediterranean was called Mare Nostrum, our sea. And the Italian frame is what Mussolini had put together with Hitler and the Axis between, and the Axis merely meant the Axis between Berlin, Rome, and Tokyo, was, in effect, a revival of the Holy Roman Empire. He said Germany must rise again. So Winston Churchill said Germany will not rise again in 50 years. Other people who have been to Germany said Germany will never rise again. It will never again become a viable world power, because they went through those cities, and I've seen the pictures, and you have, and the newsreels going back to those days, Mainz and Essen, Mannheim, and Mühlbach, Wuppertal, Köln, all of them just so utterly destroyed, 80% destroyed, just vast mountains of rubble where cities used to be. And people simply could not believe that Germany would ever rise again. Well, I happened to be in West Germany here some years back on the 21st anniversary of the Deutschmark. We did a television program over there with some of the Ruhr factories in the background on the fact that the Deutschmark is now much stronger than the American dollar, and the tremendous burgeoning boom that has taken place in the former vanquished enemies of the United States, Australia, and the Western allies of Japan, West Germany, and to a large extent even in Italy. So Germany has risen again. I merely point out that no one else said this would happen. I also point out that my father knew immediately when the war took that turn that the prophecies were nevertheless true, but that he had been in error on the exact time schedule. That World War II then must have only been the second round of a period of increasing global struggle, that the world would be locked in for a period of several decades, and that perhaps there was coming a World War III. This time, with nuclear weapons. Now, is that going to happen? Well, I'm going to talk about this same prophecy again for a moment, because there were things about it that I could not have understood prior to the Arm-Kipper War of 1973. For example, if you would read here in verse 42, that this king of the north will come into Egypt, and then in verse 43, he will have power over treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be his set. Now, the ancient Hebrew means Christian put, and if Christian put are the Libya, Ethiopia today, the political structures or entities, I would be somewhat surprised. But if you want to assume that, that's fine. It still politically makes a little sense, because they had a big flag-burning ceremony in Tripoli the other day, and Muammar Gaddafi, who was not only a supporter but an international financier of some of the terrorist organizations, and not really very infatuated at all with Sadat's regime in Cairo. So when Sadat broke all tradition of 59 years, and since Allenby conquered Palestine from the Turks in 1919, an Arab headed state has never been to Jerusalem. But Sadat took the Brittany seat and flew directly there, and you know the story, you've been reading about it. So he broke with nearly 60 years of tradition and went to Jerusalem. But Muammar Gaddafi had an Egyptian flag burning ceremony. And those people have come, as you know, almost to the verge of war themselves. They've had a lot of border conflicts along the Libyan Egyptian border very recently. This prophecy talks about the time of the end. I know that somewhere, somehow, you're going to find someone who believes he is not living in the time of the end, but let us not disturb such people. Let them sleep. I would like to remember briefly some of the great records that were set in that 1973 war, of which Sadat was so proud. I went out and looked at the Barlev line, and it stood my hair on end. I sure would have hated to have assaulted that thing as an Egyptian soldier in some little old boat paddling across the Suez Canal, for pity's sake. I never saw anything like that in my life. You'd have to imagine huge sand dunes over twice or three times the height of those curtains, just as thick as they can be, and escarpment straight up on the opposite side of a wide-open waterway, a canal right there. And 100 and some miles of huge concrete fortifications behind and underneath that huge sand dune escarpment. And every so often, a great big opening in it with the muzzle of a huge gun and machine gun. And the support all behind and down underneath and in the ground. I would have hated to make a frontal assault on that. But under cover of darkness, in one point, the Egyptian army assaulted across that canal and quickly began to build by putting rubble and so on, had it all ready, and began to actually break the canal until they got a dike across there. And they used hydro weapons. They used a high-pressure pump and hoses and began to flood portions of the canal, and the Bar-Lev line, and caused it to collapse. So the Egyptians had regained a little bit of their feelings of manhood, I guess, and I think Nasser had used up to quite some extent. He was quite proud of it. He spoke of it when I interviewed him for an hour and talked to him privately, too. And as a matter of fact, I mentioned to him he ought to go see the Israelis face-to-face, but I said that to Abi Eban and others, too. And I don't kid myself of me saying that had one thing to do with it. I doubt very much that it did. I offered to take him in my own airplane if he wanted to go, but that hardly impresses the president. He doesn't go in a 707 anytime he wants to. But I do think I have mixed emotions on it because, as I'll get to, the biblical prophecies might really say that this is rather a dangerous move for the Israeli government, if it comes to full term that it might, into not only rapprochement, but maybe a separate peace, and who knows, maybe even economic and eventually military union between those two nations. Now, that's going out on a limb. I'm not prophesying that. I'm speculating. I'm going to show you some prophecies that tend to indicate that in the time of the end, Egypt and Israel may well be cooperating together, of all things. It sounds crazy, but maybe we're seeing that beginning to happen. Well, the Sinai is broken in that Yom Kippur War. In the first place, only months before that time, some of the leaders in the American Congress had even been quoted, and so had State Department, in saying that the Arabs, the OPEC nations, will never use oil, they will never use raw materials and energy resources as a political weapon. How wrong they were. They got together, and they decided to slap an oil embargo on the Western powers as a direct result of the Yom Kippur War. If you read the book called 90 Minutes of Entebbe, you remember on the Overleaf an interview with, was it Gur, is that his name? I've forgotten, but a former, now dead, member, a deceased member of the Israeli Air Force, I think a former general, who was quoted by the author of that remarkable book as having said words to the effect that never again in the history of the mankind of world affairs would the Israeli people, the Jewish people, be led quietly away like so many sheep to be gassed or to be slaughtered in the torture camp. But he said, we, like blinded Samson, will, if we must, pull down the temple of humanity. Now, those words were very chilling, and they had quite an effect, because I happen to believe that the United States CIA understood by 1973 that the Israelis already had at least 2 and maybe 5 low yield, maybe 100 ton range, kiloton or whatever, 1,000 ton range. The government was fully prepared by little leaps that they let out from time to time that if this combined attack, because they were beleaguered on 2 and 3 fronts, and of course even though the Jordanians were involved, they were up in Syria fighting with the Syrian forces. But what if Jordan had jumped in the waist in the middle of Israel at the same time they were being hurled back and losing ground in the Sinai, at the same time they were losing ground in the Golan Heights? Because the Israelis simply had to take armored columns from one front and rush them to another front, yet they were being assaulted on 2 fronts, and this time they did not have any element of surprise. And the Egyptian Air Force had been moved clear back into Libya and over in the far, you know, outside the range of the Israeli Air Force, so they couldn't be destroyed on the ground as they were in the Six-Day War of 1967. There were several records set then. First of all, I think that the United States, under Nixon, they'd like Nixon to be killed, they'd like to crucify him, because he lied. That's mysterious to me. It's kind of like people standing knee-deep in garbage. You kept the kettle calling the pot black, or people standing knee-deep in garbage and screaming at somebody else about how dirty he is, but that's the hypocrisy of most of us in this human race. Be that as it may, Richard Nixon made a very bold decision in that event, because in order to prevent nuclear war, he made the decision to supply, no matter what it took, endlessly, no strings attached, no dollar signs attached, whatever materiel the Israeli forces needed from advanced U.S. bases in Europe, NATO bases, by which they could get those T-130s cranked up, and they can quickly put small tanks aboard and weapons and ammunition, and they could send some F-4s and so on over there, and decided to support them with unlimited conventional arms so the Israelis could withstand it, because if they didn't, he thought they might actually send atomic bombs to explode over Cairo and Damascus. And if that happened, he knew a nuclear bomb war was underway between the big powers. That was the first war in all of history in which politicians and generals thousands of miles away in the Kremlin and Washington, D.C., were being given hourly satellite photographs of warfare being conducted on the ground, and actually came to know even before Sadat and his generals knew that the Israelis had outflanked them, had gone across the canal much to the south, and were in the process of surrounding the Egyptian Third Army. The moment Brezhnev saw that, he called Washington, and they got a screeching halt. The two big powers leapt in and said, "We're going to stop it right here, and we'll start trying to find some negotiated peace." Well, the Egyptians had already been bloodied pretty well, so the Israelis, and so everybody had kind of recaptured their pride, in spite of the fact a lot of lives had been lost, and the war came to a halt. And very quickly thereafter, because the United States had transshipped weapons from forward bases in NATO in Europe on the soil of West Germany and of Belgium, the OPEC nations got together and they slapped an embargo not only on the United States, but on some of those European nations who depend up to 98% for their raw materials from the Persian Gulf fiefdom and from Saudi Arabia. And so no matter what they said in the American Congress, the OPEC nations, with the exception of Iran, had acted multilaterally. They had acted in using energy and raw materials as a political weapon. And they'd cut off the flow of oil to Europe and the very wheels of industry, of travel, of everything is going to grind to a halt in some indeterminate period of time whenever the reserves that are there on the spot are eaten up in Europe. If you would study what the dependency is of France, I imagine it's 92 or so, of West Germany, it's probably up in the high 90s, of Belgium and so on, to Eastern oil and North African oil, you would find that they, like so many other countries in this world, are utterly dependent upon the whimsical nations of Arab states in the Middle Eastern part of the world. And so from that time to this, the world has dramatically changed. Nation after nation went in a runaway balance of payments deficit, and resultant economic crises, runaway inflation, and at the same time business stagnation, or something which could never occur at the same time, stagflation, which was a new thing on anybody's horizon. And now here's a scripture buried in the dust of all of these centuries that I would have had trouble understanding until after Yom Kippur of 1973. I've been to Egypt in 1966, and Egypt is an utterly poverty-stricken country. There's no gold or silver down there to speak of, unless they've already robbed Tutankhamun's tomb, I think, and unless they're going to discover some more jewels in the Pharaoh's tomb somewhere. Egypt is an utterly poverty-stricken country. Vast manpower, little industry, if any, and during this 130 time, prior to the Yom Kippur War, the Israelis had their Abu Ghraib oil fields, for pity's sake. So the Egyptians didn't even have any oil. And yet it says here that when the king of the north goes into the area of Egypt, he will have power over the gold and the silver and the precious things of that part of the world. Well, now, from 1973, in the last 4 years, where has the wealth of the world been just poured like a golden and silver stream, but into the coffers of the Arabs? Now, the way it affects us, I don't know that much about how it affects you here in Australia on a day-to-day basis. I don't know what your dependency figure is, whether it's 10% or 20 or 40 or 90 on Arab oil. I know the last statistic I heard in the United States was 44%, but that's been some months ago, so I would imagine it's over 50% by now. That our own country is totally dependent, in spite of the vast oil reserves we've got in our Texas and Oklahoma fields, offshore and in California and elsewhere, and the Elk Hills reserves up by Bakersfield that have been given to the Navy, and the new, of course, discoveries on the North Slope in Alaska and all of that. Britain, of course, with her North Sea oil now, hoping not only to become self-sufficient, but to export. But nevertheless, during those 4 years, the economies of Western nation after nation have been dealt sledgehammer blows, and it's really hurt. In West Germany, for example, they have a twin problem of mounting runaway unemployment and of the fact that in those boom years of the late 50s and through the 60s, they brought in uncounted tens of thousands of Hungarians and Bulgarians and of Spanish and of Portuguese laborers, and those people by the tens of thousands are in big German cities. There's a big article here recently about the, I forget how many of them are, it must be about 250,000 of them or so, in West Berlin alone. And that is becoming a deep racial and social problem and a kind of a political can tied around the administration's tail in West Germany right now. When you combine unemployment and the labor laws over there, the laws of the country with regard to a certain amount of social welfareism, in which even these unemployed foreign imported people or immigrants from other countries can go down to the unemployment line and get a check. And of course, all of the taxes of the whole German populace are going to pay for unemployment compensation for people that belong in Bulgaria. And if you think that doesn't drive some of the Germans crazy, it really does. It's a big sociological problem right now. Well, as Brian Connell warned many years ago in his book, Watcher Along the Rhine, any unsavory climate in the socioeconomic picture of West Germany could divert the subventions from industrialists into the hands of very, very questionable political quarters. And as traditionally has been the case, when we see an awful lot of disorder, of mounting crime, of mounting unemployment, and we have seen the development of virtually a siege mentality because of terrorism, assassination, kidnapping. You read recently the Baader-Meinhof gang and of the assassination and or the suicide, whichever it was, of Baader and Meinhof and Erika Ulrich in the prison in Frankfurt. And then, of course, they picked up the telephone and called the West German authorities and told them where they could find the body of Hans-Joachim Schleyer, who was in a trunk of an automobile over in France somewhere. So they murdered that poor man, who had been held captive, I think, for close on to a month, wasn't it? And no one knew where he was. Well, they have kidnapped, as a matter of fact, our friend in the Japanese Diet, Mr. Sato, and another couple of the people high in the ministries there that my father's met many times, were aboard the aircraft to go down here recently and to pay, was it $3 million in that case or $5 million? I forget. But when they had hijacked this aircraft and took it down into the area of Bangladesh or someplace, and the Japanese went down there with a whole suitcase full of money, and they give these terrorist organizations the money, of course, sometimes because they don't know what else to do. Well, in the mounting wave of terrorism, many leading German industrialists and political figures have to live in sandbagged, lighted, armed patrol areas where they're looking out through barbed wire, and it's not very comfortable for them. Too many people high in government and industry are being kidnapped and turning up dead. There have been bombings and machine gunnings and so on. Traditionally, when that begins to happen and the fabric of society begins to wear thin in Germany, they take a screeching 90-degree turn to the right. Now, you just wait and see in the next month or the next years as to what government reaction will be. There tends to be sometimes overreaction to that sort of thing, as there has been to some degree in the United States. Maybe there will be overreaction. There is one magazine called Atlas, which I think is published in Britain, in which they take excerpts of international news publications all around the world, translate it into English, and put it together in a potpourri of world affairs. And this last edition has a great big swastika on the horizon and has many articles from all the Allgemeine Frankfurter Zeitung, the Die Welt and Die Zeit, and so many others of West Germany. And even in the German press, there's a great deal of apprehension being expressed about a turn to the right in government and about overreacting to this sort of a siege mentality they're getting into right now. Well, now I look at these prophecies in Daniel 11. In the wake of Mr. Sadat's very bold venture to break with 60 years of tradition and history and go down to Jerusalem and talk to the Israeli leadership and address the Knesset. And if you would go home a little later on and look up some of these prophecies, like Isaiah 30, verses 1 through 7, that warn the leadership of Judah not to trust in Egypt. If you would go back and read again the prophecies we've read so many times in Ezekiel 25 about Edom and Moab and Ammon. Edom is Esau and Esau is Turkey. And Moab and Ammon are the people of the Hashemites of Iraq and Jordan. Ammon is the capital city of Jordan. Ezekiel 25 says that those nations never did migrate. They stayed right where they were. Their ancient borders are basically intact right where they were. When the Bible talks way back in the days of Daniel about Egypt, Egypt is still there today. It was there when Daniel was there, and it's there today. Now, those political entities that perhaps were Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon are identified by different names today, just like Jordan was merely a name taken from the river, and during the British administration following World War II, it was called Transjordan and eventually became a separate nation. But the people are related, actually by blood, as are the Hashemites. And King Hussein is an Hashemite, member of that family. So, in any event, when you read in Ezekiel 25 that those nations are going to be opened unto the men of the east, that they will set their fortresses in thee, it says in Ezekiel 25. And then you read in Daniel 11 that this king of the north, who we believe to be a newly resurrected, reconstituted, weak, in time revival of an ancient combine in that same area of the world, Italy and Western Europe, is going to come down into that part of the world. You have to ask this question, why in the world would it have made sense until this little flicker of possibility on Sadat's trip now coming on the horizon, why would it make sense to anybody for a multilateral European force to attack into the Middle East and overrun both Israel and Egypt? And yet there it is in the Bible prophecy that it doesn't make any sense. Because Egypt and Israel have been traditionally implacable enemies. So why would it make any sense that he would go into the Holy Land? It says, verse 42, he will stretch forth his hand upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. And in verse 41, he will enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. Unmistakable reference to Palestine or to modern-day Israel. Why would the king of the north attack both Israel and Egypt? It doesn't make any sense, really, unless you think about the unbelievable possibility of an eventual alliance, full cooperation between those nations. Now, permit me to speculate with you for a few moments, because it's very interesting to me to try to watch, and we're told to watch, and to see what world events really mean. We have to depend upon a step-by-step sequence of events, not dates or funny little, you know, sequence prophecy somewhere that we can't understand at all, but the mainline statements of Jesus in Matthew 24. That just as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. But like as it was then, people were marrying and giving in marriage. They were going about their daily business. They were just going along as if we had all the time in the world. But he talked about drought. There's nothing religious about a drought. He talked about famine. Famine is not a religious exercise. He talked about earthquakes in diverse different places. Earthquakes are not religious meetings. He talks about wars and rumors of wars, and though holy men have been known to start wars for so-called holy purposes, there's nothing specifically religious about a war, in spite of the fact you talk about Christian gunmen. I tried to make that point to people over and over and over again. But Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, men who lived their lives in warning political leaders of the socioeconomic problems of a nation, of the fabric of society coming apart, of people who were committing every conceivable sin against God's law, which hacked away at the very basic institutions of society, the home, the school, and the church of God, as it should have been, that they received those warnings of cause and effect, that we basically bring upon ourselves the results of our own doing, that we are suffering from the consequences of our own action. I do not know anywhere right now today where God is hurting anybody. I don't know of one place on the face of the earth where God is sitting around, sort of hovering over there invisibly, and just plaguing somebody because he's smoking two packs a day, or whatever it is he's doing. Over in South Africa, in one terrible drought cycle that they were going through, a farmer hung up the sign that I talked about, a little cup out there. People put coins in, and it said, please put your coins in here to give God, to buy God a pair of glasses so we can see the terrible sufferings of man and beast. We saw a tractor plow great, huge, I guess, quarter-mile letters or so in some great big field in Nebraska, or maybe it was Iowa, and it said, send rain. We hope that God can see that. Well, if you go and visit Northern California, and if you go talk to sheep and cattle raisers in Wyoming and in Kansas, the wheat fields there, and all over the Western Rockies and Cascades, Oregon, Northern California, Idaho, Wyoming, and those states, you would find out that they're in the grip of a terrible drought, and that if it does continue throughout this next winter, the economic consequences are going to be absolutely enormous. Because there already has been water rationing, but there will be more than that. There will be water for sale in little cartons in the store for quite a little bit of money per pint, I'll guarantee you, in major California cities, if that does continue very much longer. There's nothing religious about a drought. It's not a religious exercise at all to warn people about geopolitical events, about natural, as they're called, calamities, about what is happening in world events. So permit me to speculate a little bit with you in this prophecy, and let's go back and read it in a modern context. In verse 40, chapter 11, the book of Daniel, at the time of the end. I believe this is the time of the end from so many points of view. The Club of Rome, a group of concerted scientists, none of whom have any religious affiliation, who put together a superposition of one known trend, one known curve after another. Population, pollution, energy, on and on it goes. And the lines go right out the top in the early 2000s. Any thinking person in some of the think tanks of the world would be an absolute idiot to say that this world is going to continue right on over into the next century without vast global upheavals of enormous consequence. Starving people in huge nations tend to blame the government in charge. And when the peoples of Southeast Asia and of India and other areas of this world, as they have been wont to suffer, and as they did just the other day from a terrible hurricane, or I guess they call it a typhoon up there that took so many lives, as tragic as that sounds, nations teeming with way too many people. When those suffering people living in the absolute poverty-stricken shadow of starvation, the third world countries of underdevelopment, of millions of hapless humans who never know what we take for granted every single day, begin to mount up and overthrow governments, then the world is going to become much less stable than it is even today, and it's an unstable world as it is. Anyone who thinks he is not living in a biblical prophesied time of the end is deluding himself. He's kidding himself. He's just playing a little game in his own mind. If he thinks we've got another 10 years, 15, 20 years of equilibrium, of peace, without vast global upheavals, if he thinks we do not live in a time not only where we have terrorism, but the desire specter of the potential of terrorist organizations making or getting their hands on already existing nuclear weapons. The specter of nuclear blackmail. Of even a captain of a nuclear submarine going bananas at some time or another. I mean, this is the stuff of which novels are made and movies are made. And everyone knows what the potential is. How would you like to think about a world where 40 nations have the atomic bomb? What if Idi Amin had it? For pity's sake, what would the world be like then? With some of these despots and others that are utterly insane. His body apparently ravaged by the last stages of syphilis and carrying out a policy of genocide against poor hapless people whose only mistake was to be born into the wrong race at the wrong time. Our hypocritical policies in the United States of applying selectively so-called human rights to the white democracies of Southern Africa on the allegations that those poor people down there are terribly depraved and they're suffering and all of that. Well, I've been there and I know better. Now, I know that a man comes out of the mines and he works down there and has a pitiful wage and a lot of inequities. I know there are abuses. I know there are problems. I'd be an idiot to say otherwise. But I also know that on a per capita basis, if you want to just look at it comparatively, that the black populaces of Southern Africa, Rhodesia and South Africa, are infinitely better off than any other nation in Africa, including so many other states in which there is a single-party system, a virtual despotic system, only one party. It's even true of Egypt, and where in country after country after country there is a minority government, but so long as it is a black minority government, brutally following policies of genocide against other black people that you and I couldn't even tell apart, the American government is totally silent. It says nothing. Marcel, in Mozambique, with a Marxist dictatorship, has stripped away private rights, confiscated property, and thrown all kinds of people in concentration camps. But the United States government enjoys full diplomatic relations and has not censured Marcel's government in Mozambique. Yet because Gerald Ford realized that Henry Kissinger was an embarrassment to him, because Kissinger's a better speaker than Ford is, it was an election year, and Gerald Ford needed all the black votes he could get, because traditionally the Democratic Party of the United States is the Democratic Party of the little people, the bohemians, the artists, the gay revolution, and the women revolution, and the blacks, and on and on and on. All the disenchanted elements of society, where traditionally people think of the Republican Party as the middle and upper echelon, the wealthy, conservative, and so on. Well, Gerald Ford wanted to try to appeal to those people. So playing funny little games in the world scene, with unbelievable consequences to great nations, Mr. Ford sends Henry Kissinger to muck about in the politics of Africa. Why? The United States doesn't own the world. This isn't my country. Why should my government act like it is already a global empire with a great king who rules over all, and when there's a little problem somewhere, the United States must go down there and solve it? What is that mentality?
I don't quite understand it. I don't understand human rights selectively applied. More than 1 million, some have said more than 2.25 million people have lost their lives in Cambodia just since the summer of 1975. Just since the summer of 1975, one of the absolute bloodiest, most gut-wrenching articles I have ever read, and I mean it because it's been so long since I've read some of those World War II stories, appeared in Reader's Digest some months back, maybe 6-8 months ago now, in which they broke with all tradition in their history, so far as I know. And it was an eyewitness article. You could go look it up in Reader's Guide and find out the one I'm talking about. I've forgotten the title. But it was written by some people who had been the last ones out of Cambodia when the communists took over. And they quite literally stated that people had cut their feet walking on the bones of human beings along those jungle trails coming out of Cambodia. It described scenes of whole families by the hundreds being made to kneel in front of soldiers and just bayonets shoved in them one after another to save ammunition because they weren't even worth a bullet. If it doesn't make you just bawl, don't read it right after you've eaten because you won't hold it down. I mean it. A sickening thing. And right out there for the whole world to know. You think that somewhere, somehow, some member of government, somewhere in the United States didn't read that, didn't know about it, that the CIA didn't report it, that our intelligence didn't know what was going on in a communist government in Cambodia, millions of hapless villagers slaughtered like so many sheep. Not one young, long-haired university student went around with one placard saying a thing. But when Prince Charles came to Berkeley, Berkeley gave us the free speech movement and the Sophie speech movement and the Chicago Seven. When Prince Charles came to Berkeley, there they were. Bloody Prince Charles, well, as you know so well, and Americans don't seem to know, the word bloody in the English language in England means an awful lot worse epithet than just meaning having blood on your hands, basically, as if you had been responsible for somebody's death. And these idiots, these boobs, do not apparently know that even his very, very, I think, I don't know what word to use, I just say respectable, and much admired, and I think much loved mother, Queen Elizabeth of England, does not have that much of a voice at all in politics. It was not Queen Elizabeth's decision to send British soldiers to North Ireland to keep those Protestants and Catholics from tossing bombs into crowded supermarkets and pubs and stores and blowing the limbs off of women and children. But these idiot hippies over there at Berkeley in California said, "Bloody Prince Charles, Charlie, go home." And they want him to put those troops back in England where they belong and let these people get about the business of blowing each other to bits again up there in Northern Ireland. That's the kind of political hotheads we got running around. But not one sign anywhere about Cambodia or any of those other problems happening in other nations around the world. Where are our priorities? Where are the priorities of government? I couldn't believe it years ago when I read that article that I quoted over and over again in the broadcast in which some of our politicians were appraising the chances of Lyndon Baines Johnson for re-election. And they speculated that the Vietnam War would very quickly be wound down. You know why? Because it said, quote, in the very respected USNWR, United States News and World Report, it said because Lyndon Johnson would not dare face the voters with a war on his hands. That just blows my mind. How in the world, and they were sincere. That should have sounded like one of the most unbelievable accusations against a political leader that you'd ever read in your life, to presuppose that a man could either start a war or stop a war with all that that entails in loss of property and hideous loss of life for the political expediency of maintaining himself in a political office for a few more years. It's just unthinkable. But we casually take that for granted as if that's exactly the way government is run in this world. So anyone who thinks, as we look around the world of conditions today, that we are not living in the time of the end is living in an absolute dream world, is living in unreality. We're living in a world now where the Soviet Union has achieved a breakthrough in satellite technology to where they have satellite killers, where they can have satellites get within range and actually launch a little missile and shoot our satellites out of the sky. So our spy satellites parked all over the Soviet Union taking pictures every day. And their spy satellites parked all over the United States and taking pictures of us every day can start seeking each other out and shooting one another down out of the heavens in a bizarre Star Wars kind of a thing, like Buck Rogers of yesteryear. And that's the day in which we live. And it's just mind-boggling I said, by way of analogy, so people could understand it, that if all the scrapers, bulldozers, backhoes, loaders, shovels, and other earth-moving equipment on the face of this earth could have been laboring mightily from the day Jesus walked the streets of Jerusalem until now, to scrape up a mound of earth representative of the tonnage of TNT available to man in destructive force, it would not be a mountain big enough. We have more tonnage than that available to us. So let's finish this prophecy with a new point of view about this trip that has recently happened, and maybe it makes a little more sense. Maybe it will occur this way. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. Now that's a jostling, that's a pushing. Well, what does that mean? That's not a military attack. And yet today we know that the most precious resource to all modern economies is oil. Does it mean that even Saudi Arabia, traditionally pro-Western, and even Iran, with the dream of the Shah of recreating a new Persian Empire with its super sophisticated arms given to it by the United States, would in some way join in with Israel? Could you imagine what the Middle East would be like in the next few years if it were to combine the creative and the intelligentsia, the ingenuity, the technology of the Israeli people with a per capita brain trust down there higher than any other country, like more doctors and physicists and scientists per 100 people in any other part of the world. If those people were to combine their talents with the vast manpower of Egypt, the almost limitless natural resources and the wealth of Saudi Arabia, and the sophisticated arms and so on of Iran, what kind of a block would that be? Already we're seeing the Arab League, as far as it goes, just rent right down the middle with their screaming hostility toward Sadat after his visit to upstage all the rest of them and deliberately omit out of his speech any reference to the PLO, the much of that Arafat baking and sitting and boiling in his own fat, not even mentioning them before the Knesset. So you really do wonder what in the world is going to happen next in the Middle East. But it says here, the king of the south will push at him. I wonder if that means another oil embargo of some kind. It so severely affects Europe that there is going to be a military answer the next time around. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, rapidly. Well, it was Hitler and his generals who perfected what was called in the German language blitzkrieg, or lightning warfare, striking so fast, and it was rapidly moving armored and aircraft and so on, divisions getting right into the heart of the country, that there was no time to defend against it. The chariot, we would say perhaps today, tanks, hovercraft, etc., and with horsemen, and that's infantry, and with many ships, and that's the same thing, he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape. If you read Ezekiel 25, you find out why. And even today, Syria, Iraq, and Jordan 50-50. Jordan's getting about half its arms from the United States, about half from the Soviet Union. Syria and Iraq are supported by the Soviet Union. And Ezekiel 25 says those nations will be opened under the men of the East who will set their fortresses in them. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Interesting. When it tells the Israeli leadership not to trust Egypt, that it will be like a broken reed, when they lean on it, it will pierce their hand, and it says very plainly, in one prophecy, and I'll turn to that in Isaiah 30, that Egypt will not help them at all in such a time. Let me just turn to one of them. You can look up Ezekiel 29 as another ancient prophecy. In Isaiah 30, it says, "Woe to the rebellious children, says the Eternal, to take counsel, but not of me, and to cover with a covering." Now, I've got the margin here in my old, beat-up Oxford Bible that my mother gave me when I was 12, but I didn't read till I was 23 anyway. In chapter 30 and in verse 1, it says, "A cover with a covering," and my margin says, "Weave a web or make a treaty." Now that's kind of interesting in the light of what's been happening in the last week and a half or so. "Woe unto the rebellious people that make a treaty, but not of my spirit, that they may add error to error or sin to sin, that walk to go down to Egypt, and have not asked at my mouth to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh," reference to an ancient leader in Egypt, obviously, "and to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore shall the strength of Pharaoh be to your shame, and the trust of in the shadow of Egypt your confusion." And in verse 7, it says, "For the Egyptians shall help in vain and to no purpose. Therefore have I cried concerning this, their strength is to sit still." And one way Sadat knows that, because Sadat knows that Egypt is an impoverished country, that only because of its thousands of years of tradition, of its rich heritage of culture, and of its vast manpower, is Egypt of any consequence at all. Egypt
Arabia,
to Abu Dhabi, to Bahrain, and to Dubai, and to Kuwait, and to other areas for hundreds of millions of dollars in cash to get bailed out because of its constant economic problem. Even though Sadat has invited Western industry in there to invest, when they try it, they get right down at the real hard level of saying, okay, well, let's go out to some subdivision and talk about property and talk about rail access, water access, and taxes and utilities, and talk about raw materials flowing in and about getting the people to live out here and work and getting the product back out. They find out there is such a sea of bureaucracy they get lost in, and so many hang-ups around every turn, that there has been almost no Western investment, in spite of the fact that Egypt has wanted Western investment to try to industrialize. So Egypt is not a healthy country in any sense of the word, but is broke today. Now it says here their strength is to sit still. And really, though the Israelis very generously gave them back the Abu Rhodes oil fields, and they hope to become self-sufficient, maybe even export a little bit, Egypt is not important at all in the global world community of nations today. You stop to look at it objectively the way it really is. In one sense of the word, they've got an army, yes, but they've got aging equipment, and if they don't get new American equipment to take care of the aging and non-spare parts equipped and non-Soviet technicians around to help them repair it, and believe me, all the equipment they've got in the Soviet Union in the matter of a very few more years is going to be virtually worthless to them. And they know that, and Sadat is in a great big hurry to get some American arms and to get himself back in shape to where he could either launch an offensive or at least have a good defense force. So I think it bears a great deal of introspection about that part of the world today. The king of the south, it says back in verse 40, will push at. I think that means an oil embargo. The king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind, and he enters into Egypt as well. And in verse 43, it said that he would have treasures of gold and silver and the glorious and precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians will be at his step. Now, Jesus said in Matthew 24 that we would be living in a time of wars and rumors of wars, of drought, of famine, of earthquakes in different places, and this is the very beginning of what is called sorrows or tribulation, as the margin says. And the great tribulation is called in Jeremiah 30 and 31 the time of Jacob's trouble. And it says in verse 14, this gospel of the kingdom. Gospel means good news. But unfortunately, there's an awful lot of bad news in what Jesus just said. And many people have a problem with that. I mean, I see some of this stuff on television, and these people making gurgling little sounds like a kid with a belly full of pablum, and is real happy and smiles, and, you know, the pablum leaks out of his mouth, and mother wipes it up, and they're saying, oh, praise the Lord. You know, they got people on the telephone, and there's a young girl in Missouri just gave her heart to the Lord. Oh, lovely, how old is she? 11, you know. And they talk about all these people getting converted. I don't know if that's on Australian television or not, but if you folks allow so much American television in here as we've got in my country, then you don't give yourselves but about 5 years to get about as degenerate as we are. Because it won't take long. You fill your minds with all that stuff for a few more years, like the average American kid that grows up on American television. It's unbelievable. But some of the stuff that masquerades for religion in that country, it just boggles my mind. In Honolulu on Sunday morning, on this trip, we were about to pack up and leave, and I had news of something. I flipped over there trying to get some news, and I guess no news was on. And here was a healing campaign going on, and it was some guy with a strongly flavored southern accent pretending to heal these people. At least I think he was pretending. One old fella had some hearing aids in his ears, and the guy said, you there with a hearing aid. He said, eh? You know, he says, take those hearing aids out. Walked over to him. He's got a microphone walking along the crowd to the people. And so he reached over and he took them out. He says, here, take these to your sister. And then he tucked the microphone in here and he put his hands on this guy's ear and he says, God, heal this man. You know, just ordered God around. And so he took his hands off and he yelled, you know, it hurt your ears, the volume of the TV, he said, you hear any better? And the guy said, well, yes, a little, but he said, that wasn't the real problem I wanted to talk to you about. Shut up! Say only what I tell you to say. Say praise Jesus. Praise Jesus. Say praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. Say it again. Praise the Lord. All of you say praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. Say amen. They all said amen. Say it again. They all said it again. Quietly putting this little guy back in his seat and going on to the next person. And I could not believe my eyes. I said, you mean to tell me that he can get away, that every last one of those people doesn't just get up and say, I'm going home. You know, I'm not sitting here watching this kind of thing. Unbelievable. Well, when Jesus said, beginning in verse 11, many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many, and because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold, he meant exactly what he said. That at the same time as these other global events, a great return, a great interest in religion, and all kinds of bizarre religion. We're driving down the street on the way to the airport, here with a group of guys in white robes and bald heads and little bells. That reminds me, I've got to find something here. I'll read one little tiny section quickly before I run out of time, and I'm about to do that. It might take me a minute to find it. I think I remember what part of the book it was in now, though. So I might find it quicker than I tried to do last time. Anyway, here were these guys with little jingling bells and a whole group of them. And they were out there on a busy street in Honolulu. They were the, not Zen Buddhists, what were they? The, Hare Krishna, yeah, whatever that means. Anyway, these people were there. And yeah, I mean, what good does that do? A lot of hungry people on their way to a restaurant to see a bunch of these characters jumping up and down. So that guy's jumping pretty well. Yeah, but I don't like the way he jumps near as well as I like the way the little skinny guy jumps. He jumps a little higher than the other one, you know. And you're overcome. You walk by, oh, I feel religious. Look at those characters with those little bells, you know. It's just wonderful. It just does me so much good. And it just bombs my mind. I had to put this one little part. Now, believe me, the book is not in this light vein. The book is quite serious, especially in the last couple of chapters about the crucifixion. But in this one little area, I mentioned about the types of religion that you see, of people who feel it's very important to God, of different postures and so on, and about Jesus time and again ripped away the facade of these posturing Pharisees and let the disciples and people see the futility in believing God is appeased by repetition and by human body English and posturing. Jesus showed it makes no difference if men turn around in circles, stand on this foot or that, raise this hand or the other, wear this cloak or that, carefully pronounce this word or the other, sprinkle salt, tinkle bells, light candles, thump Bibles, talk out of their mouths in colloquial accents, butcher and slaughter sheep, cattle, goats, and oxen by the thousands, rotate prayer wheels, swallow wafers, smudge ashes on foreheads, wave palms in the air, stare at the sun while it rises until they're blind, squat, kneel, stoop, splash water, leap over chairs, dab, grovel on the ground, babble and gibberish, walk with half steps, bob and weave, peep and mutter, cry tears, sing songs, smile, grow beards, shave beards, wear uniforms, drive automobiles or shun automobiles, repeat the Lord's Prayer endlessly or softly in song, bless you, Jesus, until the words lose all meaning. None of this appeases, satisfies, moves, or mollifies God. But giving, sharing, serving, forgiving, healing, helping, that's what Jesus said God's true religion is all about. I can't understand some people who feel that the only real exercise, apparently, in this life, is to get yourself saved, so to speak, to enjoy the trip like you're on a pleasure vessel with no specific port in mind, to be in a church because that's a good place to be. We gotta have churches because we need steeples in our calendars. They're a nice place in society. Keep kids off the street, to have bingo parties, to have drives to the poor, to have people sitting there and listening to sermons to get inspired for about 5 or 10 minutes before they go to play golf on Sunday or whatever. And then when it all is over on this soul factory and it's time to die and be taken to the Lord, as Merle Haggard said, happened to Elvis, it's a long way from Memphis to the mansion in the sky, where we all go wafting off up to heaven to be with the Lord forevermore. Unless, of course, we had a little flaw in our character, which, according to the Catholics, puts us immediately into some limbus or another, whether popped in front of a plain old purgatory, where we will not come out until our relatives have paid the uttermost farthing. No, that's not the way that doctrine goes. That's something else that I've read in the Bible somewhere. Anyway, people do not seem to know the purpose for human life. Why we are here? What are we doing? And where are we going? Well, brethren, why in the world did I wait 16 years to come back to Australia? I'll tell you, because I simply couldn't clear the deck with all that I've got to do over there in radio and television to get here any sooner. I had to do about 30 or 35 5-minute radio programs, many television, and of course, at least 4 of the half-hour TV and radio, plus several columns and get a lot of other stuff up, and I'll barely be right where I was. Then when I get back, I'll have run out of all of those and start in again, of course, when I get back. But traditionally, in the Worldwide Church of God, in all the dozens of campaigns that I've conducted, in all the many years that I've been involved in God's work, I have never yet given an altar call and tried to get people to join the church. The documented statistics that are available for people to look at if they wish to wonder whether or not we are sincere show through all those years of our history that out of those people who have come to us and said, now, wait a minute, I'm interested and I would like to think about baptism. I would like to become a member of your church. We have counseled with those people, waded through the scriptures like in Luke 14 about putting your hand to the plow and counting the cost and not turning back and how tough a life it might be. And Jesus said, in this world you shall have tribulation, and what it really means. and we have baptized 50%. Half of the people who come to us and say, I want to be a member of your church, do not become members of the church. Does that say anything by actual practical record as to whether or not we are some proselytizing organization? The nation of Australia doesn't have anything to fear from Garner Ted Armstrong, because I'm not here to get anything. I never have. Matter of fact, we've exported tons of American money down here for so many years until I guess the work now is really pretty much totally self-sufficient, which is terrific. You brethren are doing the work that is being done in Australia, and not one Australian dime ever finds its way out of this country to the United States. If I'd have been wanting to start a great work in Australia, I mean, so far as my own personal involvement is concerned, I suppose I'd have been down here 2 or 3 times a year in the last 16, conducting campaigns in cities and towns all over the nation. I have not been. When I was doing those campaigns in Springfield, Missouri in 1958, when my brother was killed in an automobile accident, I had been going 4 solid weeks, 7 nights a week, and doing a half-hour radio program at about 5:30 or 6 o'clock live every single morning to keep up on the broadcasting in the meantime. Never asked for one altar call, never in my life in a Sabbath service except the annual holy days where God commands it. Never in my life in any public meeting have I asked for an altar call or taken up an offering or anything of the kind. Because we believe in what it says in Matthew 24:14, that we are preaching the gospel of the kingdom as a witness unto all nations before what is called the time of the end. It says, then shall the end come. Now that's the end of man's present government. Not the end of the world, not the blowing up of the earth, not the annihilation of humankind, but the end of the civilizations on this earth as we presently know them. Then, when that gospel has been preached to enough people, when enough people have had a warning, you know, you let the chips fall where they may. It's not my fault if people do not believe when I say that drought is going to strike the United States, as I was saying for so many years, and back here in the early 70s, I said it's probably going to hit in the middle 70s. That's not because there's a specific prophecy in the Bible, by the way. I've read several articles, and meteorologists were concerned. They talk about the tendency of a 20-year cycle in our country. And they went back to talk about the fact that the 30s, the dust bowl of the 30s, and hit again in the mid-50s, it was due again in the mid-70s. Maybe we're going to go on in the mid-90s and have a really bad one. I don't know. But I was saying that very likely by the mid-70s, we're going to have a real drought, and this time it could be an awful lot worse than the one before. Because I do expect sometime in the future that this world will slide by accident into a great depression that is going to make the one of 1929 look like a Sunday school picnic in comparison. Now I'm standing here in a pulpit in a building in Sydney, Australia, in 1977. When I was last in Sydney, Australia, it was 1961. John Kennedy, I think, was in the White House, and the Vietnam War had not really even gotten started very heavily. During all those years, I had said to American audiences that your concern over Vietnam, with all the campus riots, with at one time 65 American cities having flames here and there and being confronted with armed men in the National Guard, and the nation in turmoil over Vietnam anti-war demonstrations, I said, all of your concern over Vietnam is one day going to be paled into insignificance in the light of your concern over what happens in Europe and in the Middle East. I still happen to believe that. Vietnam is nothing now but an ugly scar, a deep wound, a sore in Uncle Sam's memory, with an awful lot of tortured bodies walking around and legless and armless veterans to carry those wounds for the rest of their lives, and families who have lost their loved ones. And that war did more to destroy the pride in American power than any other calamitous event since the close of World War II. There remains no pride in American power. If you think there is an American president in office now, or that for the next foreseeable several administrations there ever will be, who will commit American troops to some far-flung battleground in some other part of the world for any purpose, you're wrong. The American government doesn't have the will. It will not do that ever again. And especially if there's the remotest fear of any communist reaction to such a commitment of troops abroad. Now, we are different. We're a different people than we were in those days when I was a boy in Oregon, and my father thought that Jesus Christ was going to come at about the time of the climactic battles at the end of World War II, and began to change immediately what he was preaching and say, then Germany has got to rise again. I don't believe you're going to see, because I see the prophecies that say the trumpet will sound the alarm to war and no man shall answer. and that we're going to go into a condition of national calamity, which could eventually result in the complete collapse of our civilizations as we know them today. I started to say that you don't have anything in Australia to be fearful of where I'm concerned. You may need to be fearful about what's developing up in Japan and in Asia, because there's a bizarre repetition of what led to World War II that is beginning to happen right now. If you want to be very circumspect in reading the news, especially the economic pages about American and Japanese screaming matches over possibility of quotas, the allegations that the Japanese have been dumping vast sums of multi-billions of dollars, steel, transistors, television sets, automobiles, and other things, because the government will subsidize the workers in big factories to keep them going, and they can afford to do that, apparently, temporarily at least, and because Americans are screaming protectionism, tariffs, quotas, surcharges, import licenses and taxes, and probably even embargoes, you may see real, terrible breakdowns in economics. Union between the United States and Japan, and that may lead to actually deeper political breakup between the two nations. And if you do, you're going to see a great burgeoning economy up there quickly go about the business of producing one of the greatest navies and air forces the world has ever seen. I guess you don't know that supersonic jet fighters have been manufactured in Japan for the last 20 years anyway, but there's no reason not to know that because it's been in aviation publications. The only thing is that most of that was under license, a piece of paper in a drawer somewhere said that Lockheed said they could do it. But now, Mitsubishi has come out with a Zero, not the Zero Zen, but the Zen, which is a brand new supersonic, all made, all designed, all produced in Japan, supersonic fighter for the Japanese self-defense forces, which is a Mitsubishi and is a modern jet fighter, reminiscent then of the Zero that, of course, was the leading Japanese aircraft during World War II. It's a sort of a strange thing that's beginning to shape up in a whole global picture of things right now. It's almost like if you crank back time to 1938 or 39 and look at the whole world, the way things are shaping up, and it's like a second time around in so many parts of the world, in Europe, in the Middle East, and even up in Japan. So as never before, we must watch and be very sharply attuned to world conditions and what it means in the light of Bible prophecy. I'd like to speculate with you a little bit here about these things in the Middle East. I'm not preaching dogma or doctrine. I'm just saying that very likely we have seen some real history made in the last few days, and it's quite likely we will see some other very strange things happening that we could never have imagined would occur, just like in 1944, if I would have told you 20 years from now, the strongest trading partners of the United States will be West Germany and Japan. And in 1944, if I'd have said 20 years from now, millions of Americans will be driving Toyotas and Hondas and Subarus and on and on and on, and will be looking at television over Japanese television sets, and taking showers in Japanese sandals, and playing baseball with Japanese gloves, and wearing Japanese suits, and building our big buildings with Japanese steel. And we will just have a flood of goods pouring into the United States from Japan. People would have called the men in white. I would have gone clanging down the street in a wagon to the funny farm, and people simply would not have believed me. A bizarre, strange thing happened, that the vanquished enemies of the Allies in World War II became the great trading partners. We put guns back in the hands of the Germans. We said we cannot defend Europe without you, and the minute we did it, the Germans have been in the driver's seat ever since. Ernst von Salomon, in his book called Fragebogen, meaning questionnaire, made light of the question about the paternal great-grandmother's maiden name of the German people to try to denazify them, because he pointed out that the denazification program of West Germany was turned over into the hands of the Germans in 1947. Not 57, 1947. 2 years after 1945, the Germans started denazifying themselves. Well, we can see how well they have done that in the next few months and years. Well, it's been good to be with you here in Sydney for this afternoon, brethren. I'm sorry that it has to be such a short time, but we schedule about 2 hours at each place, and I guess we'll be visiting with several hundred brethren, I don't know how many, in various other cities before we get on back up toward the Philippines to visit with the brethren up there in Manila. And I hope my voice holds out today. It's kind of like a mini Feast of Tabernacles for me. Of rushing out of one place and barely getting to the airport and rushing over the hall and getting another group of people waiting and talking. I know I'm kind of rambling because I'm tired and I've got my mind full of all these world events right now happening, so my apologies if I've been a little disorganized, but I hope that it hasn't been boring for you anyway, and it's put some new thoughts in your mind that you can be thinking about and maybe open up some of those old prophecies about Egypt that you haven't looked at for many, many years and begin to wonder about what's happening in the Middle East right now. It might be good to refresh your memory on some of that. You'll be getting a letter about the book very shortly. I'm due to have my second book done by the time I get back. I have a little bit of a beginning manuscript with me, And I hope to spend some time on the trip, but I'm unfortunately going to be a little bit late. It's going to be a paraphrase of the Gospel of Matthew. They want me to produce 2 books per year for the next 4 years, and that's going to take some doing together with all the other things that I've got stacked up to do. So we'll try to get as much of it done as we can anyway. I hope it's not another 16 years until I get back to Sydney.